Next up is Dr. Arthur Jones, who is going to be speaking to us on the subject of intelligent design. Arthur chairs the Association of Christian Teachers and leads the Stapleford Centre postgraduate distance learning course in Faith in Schools. Currently, he's senior tutor at the West Yorkshire School of Christian Studies in Leeds, and with Mark Rokes directs the Reality Bites programme. He also coordinates the mission-based training programme for the Church Army. He taught sciences for more than 30 years in the UK, India and Nepal, and his biology doctorate was a historical, philosophical and scientific analysis of models of origins, in which he examined the central role of metaphysical commitments in science. He's also authored Science in Faith, A Christian Perspective on Teaching Science. So please let's welcome Dr. Arthur Jones.
You've got to turn the mic on. Can everyone hear me?
Good.
Just for a start, I just want to make a statement. And that's simply to say that you have the enormous privilege today of hearing three different perspectives on science, and in particular, of course, evolutionist interpretation and a creationist interpretation. And, of course, obviously behind those or alongside them run different hermeneutical traditions and different approaches to the interpretation of Genesis as well. And of course, in the first session this morning, you had a very thorough, very good presentation of one of those interpretations of Genesis. Needless to say, there are other approaches which haven't been covered. Hopefully there'll be some response to that in the sessions later on today. But just to make that statement, you had the presence of one particular tradition in that field. Okay. But my task today is to talk about the intelligent design movement. Are we up now? Right, okay. That's it. Okay. One of my favourite verses from Proverbs is rendered like this in the Living Bible, Proverbs 18:17. Any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight. That was not, I should haste to add, directed at Keith's presentation, but rather just at the way in which intelligent design is known in this country. There's just no opportunity, really, so far, for proponents of intelligent design to present their position in the media in this country. So almost the only exposure that people get, even Christians get, is intelligent design as presented by its critics and opponents. So my task today is primarily just simply to try and give you a presentation of what intelligent design is actually about, as someone who's been part of that movement virtually since it started at the beginning of the 90s. And to say again, it's important to recognise real cultural differences and worldviews and address real positions. Often, as I say again, in connection with intelligent design, you get a rather noddy version of intelligent design opposed to a rather more sophisticated version of, say, creationism or of physics evolution. And that, of course, helps no one. There are some very major worldview differences here, and they tend to go unnoticed, not because they're hidden, but because, like a fog, they're so pervasive that nobody notices. So what is intelligent design? The first thing to say, it's an increasingly influential movement. Whereas creationism has been around for a very long time, and generally speaking, establishment in the media have ignored it, certainly the intelligent design movement has been very successful in getting itself noticed and responded to. It seems now that any scientist anywhere in the world who wants to talk about origins has to make some kind of statement about intelligent design. And if that's a measure of success, then what's happened here? Well, if you can see the program's mangled a bit, it's not a version of creationism. Next thing needs to be said, and it's not in itself an anti-evolutionary position. In fact, as we will see a little later, intelligent design movement deals with far more than evolution. So it's not really on the same spectrum as creationism and evolutionism, though, of course, obviously, it overlaps. It's a minimalist or non-creedal position. Ah, oh, dear. Apologies about this. It makes two basic statements. First of all, there's a negative statement that the intelligent assignment denies that the universe and living things are solely the product of materialistic processes. By materialistic processes, I mean processes where there is no mind or intelligence involved. And its positive affirmation is that design is real, and that sometimes at least it can be scientifically detected and therefore scientifically researched. And here we must clear away one of the first misconceptions that is widely promoted. And that's the idea that intelligent design says that some things are designed and other things are not. It does nothing of the sort. What intelligent design is primarily about is what can be detected as designed and what maybe can't be detected. That's not denying that things that can't be detected are not in fact designed. But it's primarily concentrating on those areas where design can actually be detected and therefore scientifically researched. I said it's a minimalist position, so it's intended to unite all those who have affirmed that negative and that positive, and therefore it takes no position on scripture, common descent, on the age of the universe, or the age of the earth, or the age of life. All of those are questions which will be differed on enormously by people who promote ID. They're not part of the basic ID position. Oh, dear. Yes, if you can discern that, therefore that means that people who support ID will also be either young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, some kinds of theistic evolutionists, or actually non-believers as well. So ID, in that sense, unites a huge camp of people, rather like the Anglican Church. And that's, you know, as I say, with the ID, that can be a good thing. So I wasn't making a disparaging comment there. So intelligent design has the support of some very famous secularists. There's David Belinsky, who is a secular Jew. Steve Fuller in this country, professor of sociology at Warwick, who describes himself as a secular humanist. And Bradley Monton, who's an atheist philosopher in the United States. And just to be absolutely clear about him, his support of ID is partial. He says he's not convinced by it, but he is quite sure that it's a serious proposition that his atheist colleagues ought to be taking seriously. Moving on, ID is dealing with three areas of design. Design of the universe as a whole globally, design of living organisms, and also design for science and technology. I just want to look at those very briefly. If we start with the universe, just to mention the main resource here, available both as a DVD and a book. Put it on Amazon if you want to find out about it. The Privileged Planet, by an American philosopher and an American astronomer, detailing the tremendous evidence of fine-tuning in the universe. So that was a DVD. There's the book and the two authors, Jay Richards, philosopher, theologian, Guillermo Gonzalez, top-notch astronomer. And they, in their book, just detail all the tremendous evidence, which is, I think, hardly disputed amongst Christians, of just how incredibly designed the universe appears to be. Everything, in terms of its laws, in terms of its constants, appears to be just right for life, in fact, just right for intelligent life. So, as Keith mentioned a little bit, the constants and equations for gravity, electromagnetism, the strong, weak nuclear forces, the ratio of the proton to electron mass, numerous parameters of the universe at large, the location of the sun, various parameters of the galaxies, solar system, planet, and so on, go on and on and on. I'm going through these very quickly because they're all there in the notes if you want to look them up on the CD. But just enormous number of parameters which seem to be just right for life to be possible, intelligent life to exist, and if any of them are just nudged even slightly in most cases, life simply would not be possible. And even the sun, I mean, commonly in the literature, even today, people talk about the sun being an average star. In fact, it isn't at all. It's quite an unusual star in terms of its presence in the universe. The size, the temperature, and the type of sun are quite specific for life to be possible. And the Earth itself is the same. The distance of the Earth from the sun, its size, its axial tilt, its rotation speed, the presence of an unusually large satellite, the Moon, its composition, and so on, go on and on, again, are incredibly fine-tuned. Why have we got some of those big planets in the solar system, like Jupiter and Saturn, seen there? Well, again, they give a stability to the solar system which would not be there in their absence. Jupiter, in particular, acts as a comet and asteroid magnet, shielding the Earth from numerous catastrophic collisions which otherwise occur. Not completely eliminating, but eliminating most of them. So that's the universe. And as I say, amongst theistic evolutionists, creationists, intelligent design people, there's very little dissent on that area of design. So in that sense, lots of those who call themselves theistic evolutionists actually would belong fairly and squarely in the ID movement as well, even some who deny it. But living organisms, again, I'd recommend two DVDs from the Intelligent Design Movement, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and one that's just come out in recent months, Darwin's Dilemma, looking at the famous Cambrian explosion, the fact that at the very base of the fossil record, you find practically all the body plans that we find in the animal plant worlds already present. If you want a book on this, then Dr. Michael Denton, a New Zealand molecular biologist, biochemist, has written a book called Nature's Destiny. I think it came out in 1998, in which he details in enormous detail the amazing way in which everything to do with biology and biochemistry is just again finely tuned for life. So huge numbers of very precise mutual adaptations in the physical and chemical properties of the constituents of cells. The fact that water seems just uniquely designed for carbon-based life. The mutual fitness of sunlight and life. The fitness of oxygen and oxidations for the support of life. The fitness of carbon dioxide for waste removal. We talk a lot today with global warming about carbon dioxide being this terrible pollutant. But actually, apart from the worries there, carbon dioxide is an incredibly important and essential molecule for life. The fitness of bicarbonate as a buffer against acidity and alkalinity, the mutual fitness of DNA and proteins. In nearly every case, writes Michael Denton, these constituents are the only available candidates for their biological roles, and each appears superbly tailored to that particular end. And in the past, there have been many scientists who have said, well, maybe life could be based on ammonia instead of carbon. But every attempt to try and show how that's possible has just been a dismal failure. The particular elements and molecules that are used in life just seem to be just so uniquely designed, and nothing else appears to be available. So science has revealed, writes Michael, a universe stamped in every corner, riven in every tiny detail, with an overwhelming and all-pervasive biocentric and anthropocentric design. And taking up that last word, one of the other features of design, which has only really been articulated in detail in recent times, is the fact that not only does the universe seem incredibly designed for life and intelligent life, but also for the development of science and technology. In relation to both the physical and the biological sciences, there is an incredible complementarity of design. The universe is not only incredibly fine-tuned for the Earth to be a home for intelligent life, Earth-like planets are also the only places in the universe from which the universe can be seen and investigated. Something's not been realized very much until recently, that most places in the universe are not suitable for observation. You're either completely blinded by nearby stars, or immersed in dust, or in areas where the radiation is so intense that nothing could live, and so on. There are very few places, it turns out, where you can actually be, where the universe is actually open to your investigation and can be seen. The Earth is one of those uniquely rare places. And again, that book I mentioned, The Privileged Planet, and the DVD go into that area, and so does Michael Denton in his book. Also worth mentioning that human beings, in terms of our size and our abilities and capabilities, seem to be incredibly designed for the development of technology. Any creature smaller than us couldn't use fire, for example. Interesting thought. So that's the three areas of design. But again, just to make the point, let me emphasize it, the interior design movement is far more than just evolution. So there's a great deal that's been developed in that movement, which I'm sure Keith and most other thesis evolutionists would have no trouble with whatsoever. So it's only some of the more specific things where there is a conflict. But I want to just say a little bit about information, because information and information sciences have been one of the main areas of development and concern for proponents of intelligent design. In fact, it's probably true that the two of the major areas of support for ID worldwide are engineers and those involved in information sciences and computer sciences. Enormous numbers of people in Microsoft, for example, belong to the intelligent design movement. But that might sound like a bad thing for those of us who've got experience as a PC. But never mind. So what is information? What's happening here? Right. Information, the first thing to say, information is irreducible to physics and chemistry, to matter and energy. In fact, there are many today who would argue, both scientifically and philosophically, information is a third category in the universe. And for example, you can have the same information and you can convey it as writing on paper, as magnetic points in a computer's hard disk, as electric domains in a random access memory, as bumps on a CD, or as bases in DNA. In other words, the actual material carrier doesn't matter. The information can be put in any number of those forms. It's something that's independent of the material carrier. But information in living organisms, information in living organisms is coded information. And that's one of the remarkable things that we've known since the DNA revolution in the 1950s, that the information that's required for the development of organisms is present in an intricately complex code, the DNA code. But a thing that needs to be emphasized, that in biology, in living organisms, that coded information is expressed through biological machines. Without those complex machines which populate all the cells of our body, that information could not be utilized, could not be used. The two go together. So we say very quickly, but what do those machines do in our cells? They capture the random energy of our environment. They raise the local free energy. That's energy which can actually be used to do things. You know, most energy, like, for example, the heat that's filling this room, is not accessible. You can't actually capture it to do anything useful. And that's what scientists mean when they talk about free energy. They mean that energy which is actually available to do something useful, like run a machine or do a biological function. So those biological machines, which our cells are full of, can carry out a useful function. But they can only do that function if they have the information to do so. So you have a chicken and egg situation here. That the information is useless without the machines which can utilize it and perform the function, but those machines can't actually do anything without the information. So a familiar problem in science, which came first? You need them both together. But to emphasize the point from that random energy flow will produce neither the machines nor the information. So I'd still affirm that idea that because the Earth is receiving enormous amounts of energy from the sun, that therefore somehow evolution can happen on Earth, is, as far as we know from any evidence or science, just absolute nonsense. Before that energy can be used to do anything, you need machines, and you need the information from those machines to utilize. The energy on its own can't produce either of those two essential components. Naturalistic mindless processes will produce neither living organisms nor new biological systems. Again, let me say, I mean, science will often say, well, but you can't prove that there's no naturalistic process which can do that. Fair enough, of course you can't. You can never predict what's going to happen in science. But aren't scientists claiming here and now that they have a scientific theory of evolution? They haven't. And it'd be nice if they just admit that. Let me just say something else about machines. Machines do not contravene physical laws and processes in any way, but they cannot be reduced to them or defined by them. They harness them for the purposes specified by their technological design. Just emphasizing the importance of science. Here's a point made by the philosopher and physical chemist, Michael Polanyi, about 50 years ago. And living organisms, in exactly the same way, do not contravene any physical laws and processes in any way. Now, this is not vitalism, but they cannot be reduced to them or defined by them. They harness them for the purposes specified by their biological design. Let's take just one other aspect of this information problem. And let me use an illustration. In the English language, if you just take three-letter words, about one in 30 have a meaning in English. So, example, hat, cat, can, tan, tin, bin, bun, fun, fen, and so on and so on. There are lots of three-letter combinations in English which actually have a meaning in the English language. So it's very easy to change one letter at a time and go from one word to the other. So by, you know, one nucleotide, as it were, genetic mutation, you can easily convert one of these words into another. And there's a sort of sequence there. And, you know, there's just a visual representation. Those red dots are roughly 1 in 30 of all the dots on that screen. So as you can see, although there are gaps, it's quite conceivable that you could jump over them by mutation, as it were, one to the other. But what if we move on to seven-letter words? There's a phenomenal number of seven-letter words in English. But in fact, only about 100,000 seven-letter combinations mean anything in English. So that if you represent that in that same sort of graphical way, it gets a bit difficult. There's one grid with one red dot, one seven-letter word that actually means something in English. You would then have to go through hundreds of grids like that before you find another grid with a seven-letter word that means something in English. In other words, by one-letter changes or even two or three-letter changes, the chances of getting from one seven-letter word that means something in English to another is pretty remote. In fact, effectively impossible. But what if you turn to 12-letter words like hypothesis, behaviorism, psychopophysis? Well, you find then only about 1 in 100 trillion 12-letter combinations in English mean anything in our language. So, you know, if you go for that grid again, you're going to have to go through actually millions, in fact billions, of those grids before you find a single red dot. The chances of finding a genetic mutation to go from one to another is just simply out of the question. The probabilistic resources, as the expert would say, are simply not there. Now that, of course, is words, and words are arbitrary. You can put any number of letters together, and if you decide it's going to have a meaning, you can make it have a meaning in the English language. And there are some words that look most un-English, and yet they are there in the dictionary. But the amino acid sequences in our proteins in our bodies are not arbitrary at all. And it's not just seven letters or 12 letters. The proteins of life contain hundreds or thousands of amino acid letters. And we find that there are only small islands of functional protein in vast, astronomically vast oceans of non-function. So if you find that little island where the proteins actually do something useful in biology, you have to go through, well, universes of ocean before you find another little island. And let me stress what's been said here. Those islands are separated by thousands or millions of bits of information. And no known natural processes have been shown to be able to cross even a 50-bit information gap, not even in computer simulations. Let me emphasize that those proteins are not arbitrary like words in a language. It's been shown now that most amino acid combinations do not fold to form a stable structure. And unless that can happen, no biological function is conceivable. So most amino acid combinations cannot form a protein with any function whatsoever. It's not arbitrary like letters. So there's an enormous problem here. And again, I want to emphasize, of course, scientists can come back and say, but there might be some naturalistic process we've not discovered yet which can get across these enormous information gaps. Fair enough, one can never deny that. But again, I make the point, scientists are constantly claiming that we already have a scientific theory of evolution. And again, they say, no, you haven't. You have got no process that you can demonstrate that can cross these information gaps. Until you have, you should not be claiming that you have a scientific theory, because you haven't. No, I've just said that. But just, again, saying ID is not an argument from incredulity. It's not a God of the gaps argument. And let me just say against Keith, there's actually nothing wrong with God of the gaps arguments. That's used as sort of a stereotype dismissal phrase. But actually, the philosophers and historians have actually done some research on how God of the gaps arguments have functioned historically, have come to an astonishing conclusion that they've actually been used in a good way. And there's no evidence of any systematic misuse of that type of argument. And if you again look in the CD, you will see references to three scholarly papers on that subject, which I hope would change your perception of God of the gaps arguments completely. But in any case, ID is not that kind of argument anyway. ID is an empirical approach that rejects the rationalism associated with evolution. I'll come back to that in a moment. The argument for ID is not that we do not know how it happened, therefore God did it approach, but a thoroughly empirical one. And as I said at the beginning, numerous aspects of organic life appear to be design-like. Everyone agrees on that. Even Richard Dawkins says that biology looks designed, living organisms look designed. And then negatively, no known naturalistic process can produce the necessary amounts of functional information. On the other hand, we do know one thing which can cross those huge information gaps. Naturalistic processes that we know so far cannot, but we do know that intelligent agents such as humans can produce unlimited quantities of new functional information. So we know no known naturalistic process can do it, we do know intelligent agents can. And that effectively is where ID rests its case. Irreducible complexity that Keith referred to, complex specified information that another ID put forward, are interesting and may well be right. And they've certainly not been disproven, but they're not at the core of ID. ID, as I emphasize again, is an argument from evidence, the evidence of the inability of unguided natural forces to produce even relatively small gains in functional information. I say, even in the most favorable computer simulations, naturalistic processes have not been shown to produce more than about 50 bits of information, whereas the gaps we're talking about are thousands or millions of bits of information. Intelligence can cross those gaps. Chance naturalistic processes have not been shown to cross even a small gap. And I say, no theory that lacks such crucial support can be regarded as robust. And as I say, in science one can never say what might not be found in the future, but I'm talking about what the situation is here and now, and asking for some honesty about where we are. Quickly moving on, one of the main things that ID wants to point out and assert is that evolution, as we know it today, is largely based on a philosophy of materialism. So what do we mean by evolution? And just remind ourselves that evolution is, as a word, is used in at least four clearly different ways. Sometimes it just means that organisms change over time. Variation. And let me say that no one disagrees with that. Creationists, intelligent design people, theistic evolutionists, secular evolutionists, all agree that change and variation occur. Or evolution might be used to mean Darwin's natural selection theory. Well, again, there's no dispute on that. In fact, natural selection historically was first put forward by creationists before Darwin. It wasn't even his theory originally, though he's the one who's now associated with it more than anyone else. Natural selection occurs in nature, no problem. The third meaning of evolution is universal common descent. Now here, of course, creationists will differ with that. Some ID people will. But their most important meaning of evolution today is as a materialistic theory. And that's how Dawkins and many others use it to mean. So I need to emphasize that definitions of evolution are not neutral. Every definition has its own particular worldview context, and today the dominant worldview in our societies in the Western world is materialism. And just to remind you what materialism is, it's a view that says that physical nature is all there is, that there's no immaterial realm beyond physical detection, no spirit, soul, angels, God. There's no independent existence of mind. There's no intelligent design or purpose behind what work in the universe. They might have evolved within it, but they're not original to it. They're not essential to it. There's no moral order in the universe. That's something that humans invent, and it changes through their history and development of their societies. And the universe, therefore, is either eternal or self-generating in some way. And there are science philosophers today, secular science philosophers, who will defend both of those alternatives. The idea that the Big Bang, for example, has shown there was a moment of creation is something that many philosophers and scientists would dispute strongly. So there is a secular story that runs very powerful for many people in our society today. The idea that in the beginning was nothing, but somehow that nothing gave rise to something. And over billions of years, that something gave rise to life. And over more millions of years, that life gave rise to intelligent life. But it's all by chance. It's all from nothing. There's no God. There's no plan. There's no purpose there. And the thing I want to emphasize is that both its original author, Charles Darwin, and its leading modern proponents, there's John Maynard Smith, Stephen Dennett, Steve Jones, and Richard Dawkins, Darwinism, for all of those, is the materialistic theory of origins. And I want to emphasize that because there's been a lot of rewriting of history in the last year, particularly about Darwin. Darwin was a convinced materialist from very early on in his life. When he went as a young undergraduate to Edinburgh, he was very influenced by some of the materialist professors there. There was a materialist club at the university which he never missed a meeting of, and he was clearly a convinced materialist from that point onwards. Where the problem comes in, he would not have identified himself at any stage in his life as being an atheist. But he was a materialist, and that is clear from his notebooks, from his letters, and from many of the conversations that his friends record. And that's the dominant view in the secular world today. When many scientists today talk about evolution, they mean materialistic evolution. And Darwin, and of course, if you're a materialist, then Darwinism is then the only game in town. Richard Dawkins' T-shirt there, Evolution, the Greatest Show on Earth, the Only Game in Town. And, of course, that's given its title to his latest book, which is probably the next slide. Yes, there it is. His book just came out very recently. And just to give a typical quote, a very famous quote from Richard Levantin, probably the world's leading geneticist. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation for the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow the divine foot in the door. That was exactly Darwin's sentiment. And that's exactly the sentiment of his modern followers. And of course, if that is your philosophical religious commitment, then Darwinism is indeed, at the moment, the only game in town. But on the other hand, if it's not your philosophical religious commitment, then suddenly the evidence for Darwinism and for evolution itself starts to look incredibly thin. But to emphasize again, Darwinism is the secularist materialistic origins myth. And let's run very quickly to the next bit. I wanted to say something very quickly about the religious root of evolution, because commonly it's presented as if creation or creationism is a religious view, whereas evolution is a scientific view. Whereas, in fact, it doesn't matter what theory you're looking at in science, you're talking about these big theories, paradigms as they're often called, then there's always some kind of philosophical or religious framework in the background if you dig deep enough to find it. So where did evolution come from? Well, you have to go back to the ancient Greeks and look at the situation. We live in a universe. The universe seems to have an incredible unity to it, which is rather inexplicable. We can intelligibly, rationally reason about it. It makes sense. It doesn't change. Our minds can grasp it. Without that unity and order that we perceive out there, we could have neither philosophy nor science. So where does that unity and order come from? How do we account for it? And amazingly, the view that was put forward, assume there is no creator outside the world, and you've got to find that unity within the world, what was put forward was the philosophy that we now today call evolutionism. And the idea is that everything that's ever existed is part of a great continuity in space and time, that the unity, the ordered universe, is simply the fact that it is an evolving unity. It is a great continuity in space and time. Well, in fact, in terms of the Greeks, they regard its continuity here and now in its development over history. It's become an evolving, developing continuity. And somehow that's supposed to account for the rational unity and order that the universe displays. And I'll say to you, well, I think that's nonsense, but that's the philosophical tradition. It's a tradition called the Great Chain of Being, and if you're interested, you can look it up. That principle of continuity is seen as the only possible naturalistic basis for reason and science. But again, I want to say, although many scientists repeatedly will talk about the principle of continuity or the law of continuity, again, in my CD notes, you'll see lots of quotations that I give there to illustrate the way in which science referred to this principle. But in fact, there isn't any such principle known to science. It's not an empirical finding of scientific investigation. It's not a theoretical principle of proven fruitfulness. It is simply a dogma of the evolutionist faith. If evolution is held to be true in that materialist sense, then this continuity is taken for granted as its basis and justification. Then quickly, just to finish off, just to remind you of just two other things. One, something very simple. There are not many foundational laws in biology, but there are two very well-known ones. The first one, the law of biogenesis, that living things arise only from other living things. In fact, if there's anything that can be claimed in science to be a law, probably that would win hands down, because we have never found any evidence whatsoever at any time that contradicts that law. In our experience as human beings throughout history, living things arise only from other living things. Interesting. But there's a second law of biology, the law of heredity, that living things arise only from other living things of the same kind. And again, we have no evidence whatsoever, either today or in history, of any contradiction to that law either. The kind of cartoons that you often see, like this one, Dalmatian dog with a lot of spotted cat saying, "Honey, please just calm down, let me explain," makes lovely cartoons. But nothing like that has ever been experienced by any human being in history. And if you take bacteria, and I take bacteria because, they've been experimented upon more than anything else, and we have bred thousands, tens of thousands of generations of bacteria in the laboratory, and yet we have not produced a change even that could be regarded as a change of species. Here's Alan Linton, retired bacteriologist, now professor at Bristol University. For over 150 years of the science of bacteriology, there is no evidence that one species of bacteria has changed into another. After tens of thousands of generations in the laboratory, with scientists trying every way they possibly can to make them change. And yet still that law of heredity holds absolutely unrefuted. Again, I'd say, okay, fair enough. Maybe you'll, in the future, produce something that contradicts that law. But I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what's the situation here and now. So often you secular scientists are claiming that we have a scientific theory that's proven. Oh, no, you don't. And then just finally, heredity is much more than DNA. Again, neo-Darwinian theory is based purely on the assumption that DNA provides the blueprint, the recipe, whatever you want to describe it, for all of life, for all of our biological features. And yet we have known for about 60 years that that is simply untrue. But a great deal of heredity is coded in ways in which we do not yet understand in the rest of the living cell. Is it possible to jump onto slide 100? You should be able to just put in 100 and press enter, and it should go to that slide. Otherwise, I'll have to run through it quickly. The slides I want to jump over simply just go through all the evidence for the fact that heredity is far more than DNA. And in fact, we know that a great deal of the three-dimensional structure of the cell is in itself a hereditary system that probably has much more to do with body plans than DNA. DNA codes for all the materials of life, but not the architect's plan. Let's see if we're getting there. And with that, I'll be able to finish. Apologies again for the fact that trouble with PowerPoint is you compose it using one particular version of Microsoft's program, and when you try and play it on the computer which has another version, and things go wrong, as you saw very much at the beginning. So apologies again for that. Okay. The slides are all on the CD. So just let me say, it's the idea that DNA is all of heredity is like saying, if you take a CD, if you look at it under a microscope, you'll see it's just a series of microscopic bumps that are then read by the CD player that you put your CD in. To say that DNA is responsible for the whole of life, the whole of heredity, is like saying that those bumps on the CD generate not only the music, for example, you might listen to, but also the CD player, the amplifier, the loudspeakers, everything to do with the system. Of course, we know that's absolute nonsense. Those bumps in CD do nothing of the sort. In the same way, DNA does not code for the systems that decode it and utilize it in bringing life into existence. So there's a lot more to science, but I hope I've given you some insight. There is another case to be heard than the one for evolution, and particularly the case for intelligent design. Thank you.